Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I can remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. Love never fails. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, then that which is done in part will be done away with. When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I also am known. And now abide faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. We've been looking at this wonderful chapter, the love chapter in the Bible, which Paul penned for the Corinthians, who needed to understand what real love was supposed to look like. And last week, we looked at the importance of love. And we looked at how the gift of tongues is useless without love. The gift of prophecy is useless without love. You could be the greatest orator in the world, that you could be one who is so spiritual and can speak with other tongues and have all these spiritual gifts. The gift of knowledge is nothing without love. The gift of faith is nothing without love. The gift of giving is of no value without love. These gifts, the biblical gifts of the Spirit, are of no value without the biblical love connected to them. And this week we'll look at the essential nature of this love in verses 4 through 7. You know, the area of Corinth was long before Christianity was known as a city of love in a worldly sense. There existed there a temple to Aphrodite, the goddess of love, a temple dedicated to her on the high hill near the city. And it has been populated by temple prostitutes who taught, and they taught that sexual love with them was the way to truth. And it's interesting because this behavior was accepted in their society. There was a misconception in that day of that. It also housed the temple of Dionysus, the Greek god of wine and intoxication, and the temple of Isis, the Egyptian goddess of magic. Corinth was an ungodly party town at best, but it was known in that day amongst the many visitors who would come, including the sailors who would come after many months at sea, for the lively Corinthian welcome. It became known to the world as the love city and appears to be the capital of this immoral love that the world knew in that day. Paul, as the Corinthians began to come to Christ, needed to give them some bearings, give them some understanding of biblical love. And so he gives them this chapter. He pens chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians, and especially here in verses 4 through 7, where we find the very definition of love, biblical love. And I want you to notice, first of all, that it has nothing to do with feelings. It doesn't say anything about feelings. In fact, each one of these words are action words. This section breaks down neatly into four categories. First of all, verses 4 and 5, love's response to others. Verses 5 and 6, love's relationship to self. The second part of verse 6, love's reaction to sin. And then in verse 7, love's regard for life situations. First of all, love's response to others. It says, love suffers long. Or the King James says, love is patient. Long-suffering is the idea. We see this acted out in the person of Jesus. In 1 Peter chapter 2, it says, for to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, did not revile in return, but committed himself to the one who judges righteously. Jesus practiced this long-suffering love when he went to the cross. 2 Peter 3:9 says, the Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. This word long-tempered or long-suffering means long-tempered or long time in rising of your temper. It denotes a long waiting of a refusal to give in to anger. It is the quality of self-restraint. It is the quality of having a long fuse. That's the idea. I was reading about an atheist by the name of Robert Ingersoll. And, you know, he somehow thought he could exhaust the patience of God. He said, I'll give God, he would give lectures. And in the middle of his lectures, he would stop and say, I'll give God 5 minutes to strike me dead for the things I've said. And then he used the fact that he wasn't struck dead as proof that God did not exist. One of his counterparts in his debates, Theodore Parker, said of Ingersoll's claim, and did the gentleman think that he could exhaust the patience of an eternal God in 5 minutes? I like that. Heard the story of a teacher who used this in a little different way. He was standing on a platform much like this, and he said, if God is real, then why doesn't he just knock me off this platform in the next 5 minutes? If God knocks me off this platform in the next 5 minutes, I'll believe in him. And so in his classroom, 4 minutes went by, 4.5 minutes went by, about 4 minutes and 45 seconds into the 5 minutes. A linebacker from the back of the room came forward and plastered the guy on the ground. And the teacher said, what are you doing? Why are you knocking me down? He said, God was busy. He sent me. I like that one. I want to meet that guy. As believers, we come to this place of applying love to our life. And when we do, we'll not quickly take offense or seek revenge. We will patiently bear with someone who has wronged us. Not just in word, but in deed. Think of this. How long-suffering was God toward you? How long-suffering has he been toward this world that has rejected him? Jesus himself, of course, was so long-suffering with both the Jews and the disciples. I see it in a different way. With the Jews, he was long-suffering in that if I were Jesus, the way the Jews were questioning him and treating him, I'd have just made them into post-toasties, you know? Or the disciples who were always asking, who's the greatest? And always concerned with their position in the kingdom. You know, I would have taken those guys and just smacked them in the back of the head. But Jesus, he was long-suffering. He was patient with them. Because love is patient. It's long-suffering. I'm not always patient. We live in such a society that is not patient, right? We are so impatient, we stand at the microwave and watch it tick. Right? We're just waiting for our food to heat up and come on, I'm hungry, you know, it's 2 minutes. Oh, you know. Love is patient. Love is kind. It has been said that love is blind, but biblical love is not blind, it's kind. Love sees the faults of others, but is willing to overlook them because of the love that they have for that person. Again, this is a verb. And it denotes a disposition to put oneself in the service of others. Passive love is patient, but this is more. This is active love or kindness. It disposes to do good. It's a specific kind of love. A person who loves is one who is patient and kind with an elderly grandmother or a cranky neighbor or an insensitive boss or a troubled teen or just someone who's just plain mean to them. I know I need to understand this kindness of God. That God in his love is kind, and we need to be kind to one another, to people. You know, when I was a kid growing up, I was not kind. I grew up in a volatile household, and I beat my brother up every day, whether he needed it or not. It's just the way we grew up. He was 3.5 years younger than me, so I took advantage. In fact, when my wife first came to our home, we were in the kitchen, and I had this big blowout with my sister, and I pushed her up against the refrigerator and got mad at her and yelled and screamed at her, and all of a sudden I turned around, and my wife was gone. She's out in the car. I go out, and I find her in the car. She's sitting in the car crying. I said, "What's wrong with you? Why are you crying?" "Well, the way you treated your sister." I said, "What do you mean? I always treat my sister that way." It was just part of who we were, and some of us grew up that way. Some of us have that kind of background where kindness is not a natural part of our lives. But all the more how God can change your life and make you into a person who is kind. Being kind is something we can have the opportunity to practice every day. You know, you can choose to be kind. If you're in the grocery store and you're in the grocery line, and I know you only have 8 items and you're hoping to get out of there, but then there's someone comes along and they're fumbling through their stuff, you can actually let them go in front of you. That would actually be patience and kindness together. Or when you're on the highway and you're stuck in traffic and that person's trying to pull in from the right lane, you know there's a gap, you need to, you know, let them in. You can let them in. You can actually let them in. You don't have to ignore them and look forward. And I know you do that. And you got to be careful when you're driving by the area of the church, by the way. You never know who's going to see you. I've unfortunately had that happen to me. One day I was driving to church, and I was rather late, so I was speeding, and one of the wonderful Howell police officers pulled me over. So here it was, this is when we had 9 and 11 as our services, here it was 10 minutes to 9, and all the church cars are driving by, Pastor Chris. "What are you doing out there, Pastor Chris?" I'm being kind to the police officer here. Heard about an article in the newspaper about a young boy who went to a lingerie department of a store to purchase a gift for his mother. Bashfully, he whispered to the clerk that he wanted to buy a slip for his mom, but he didn't know her size. The woman explained that it would be helpful if he could describe her. Was she thin, fat, short, tall, or what? "Well," replied the youngster, "she's just about perfect." So the clerk sent him home with a medium-sized slip. The article reported that a few days later, the mother came to the store to exchange the gift. It was too small. She needed a considerably larger size. The little fellow had seen her through the eyes of love, which always looks beyond external appearances. The kindness of love won't focus on the shortcomings. This doesn't mean that you're blind to a person's weaknesses or sins. But it does help us in that we look behind, accepting people as they are, looking at their best qualities and wanting their best for them. When Jesus walked the earth, he was so kind to people who were downtrodden. I think of the woman caught in the act of adultery, or the man who was laying lame there by the pool of Bethesda, and he helped them. He had compassion on them, and he healed him. And he restored her. Jesus was kind. Love is kind. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not envy. It is not jealous. Envy and jealousy are really difficult things. We see many biblical examples of them. The word is used to express any wrong feeling when viewing the good of others. You see someone else who's blessed. They get a new job, they get a new car, they get some blessing in their life. And you get a twinge of, well, why aren't I being blessed? That's envy. That's jealousy. We see, again, many biblical examples. Cain's envy of Abel's acceptance of his worship. And, of course, that led him to murder. Joseph's brothers sold him into slavery because of envy. Daniel was thrown into the lion's den because of the jealousy of the fellow officials in Babylon. You see, real love does not resent the blessings, successes, or well-being of another. If you find yourself being jealous of another's position or status in life, that's not how love thinks. And we need to repent of that. Love does not envy. It's not jealous. Well, love relates to others that way, but then love has a relationship to self also. Notice in verse 4, the end of verse 4, love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, it does not seek its own. You know, selfishness is the root of so much of our problem. Our biggest problem in life is the man or woman in the mirror. And I confess, I am a selfish person. I need to grow in this grace. Love does not parade itself. It doesn't boast. Love doesn't talk about oneself. It doesn't show off one's accomplishments. It's really tough to be around a person who's always boasting about themselves. We all like to be around people who don't talk about themselves, but they actually talk about you. They ask you about you. They're interested in what's going on in your life. The idea, really, when you look at these next two, this one and the next one, love is not puffed up, is the idea is that love is humble. There's a great thing when someone who has accomplished great things and they give praise to others when they're asked about their accomplishments. I think of Derek Jeter when he won the World Series in 2009. His fifth World Series, he said, if you have accomplished things, people will talk about it for you. You don't have to point it out. And it's true that even when he is interviewed so often, he points to his teammates and gives them the credit for the wins. Biblical love doesn't parade itself. It doesn't show off. And as Christians, we really should praise others for their roles in our life. It's not proud. It's not puffed up. I was reading about John Wooden, the UCLA coach, the best coach of all time, hands down, basketball coach. Won 10 national championships in a row. Here's what he said about pride and humility. Talent is God-given. Be humble. Fame is man-given. Be grateful. Conceit is self-given. Be careful. I like that. It's because pride is a grievous thing in the eyes of God. It's one of the things that God hates the most. Love is not proud. It's not puffed up. You know, it's always better to put yourself in a lower place than in a higher place. Jesus gave a parable about that. He said, when you come into a place, a banquet, you know, don't go to the highest seat. Don't go to the best seat in the house. Because if someone has to come to you and tell you to move down, you're going to be embarrassed. That's not going to be cool. I'm paraphrasing the parable. But he said, when you come, take the lowest place. And then if someone says, come up higher, well, then you'll be blessed. Imagine how embarrassing that would be. You're sitting at the king's table and they come and say, excuse me, you're not allowed to sit there. Oh, why not? Because you're low. Go to the back of the room. That's difficult to hear. It's always better to put yourself in that lower place. William Carey is thought by many to have been the founder of the modern missionary movements. Christians all over the world know who he was and honor him. He came from a humble place. He was a shoe repairman that God called to reach the world. Once Carey sat at a dinner party, a snobbish lord tried to insult him by saying very loudly, Mr. Carey, I hear you were once a shoemaker. Carey replied, No, your lordship. not a shoemaker, only a cobbler. The name of William Carey is remembered today by many, but nobody remembers that snobbish lord. His love showed itself as not having a big head about himself. Paul has mentioned to these Corinthians several times through the texts we've studied in the past about not being puffed up. When it came to sexual immorality and them being sort of proud of the fact that they were being gracious to a sexually immoral person in their midst, or when they were suing each other and getting ready to sue one another, he said, do not be proud, do not be puffed up. Love is not puffed up. Love is not rude. It doesn't behave rudely. Literally, the word means unremainable or unabidable behavior. You know, when someone is rude, you just don't want to be around them. Not having the conduct that creates the desire that a person would remain there. They behave themselves, people who behave themselves honorably during any situation can do so because of agape love. When behavior is disgraceful and dishonorable, we can know that agape love is not there. 1 John 4 says, beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone that loves is born of God and knows God. And he who does not love does not know God, for God is love. The secret to politeness, courteousness, respectfulness is God's agape love. Love-controlled behavior does nothing which would make you ashamed. Real love will never ask another to prove their love by doing something wrong. Real love will never prompt you to do that. You young people, young ladies especially, some young fellow comes along and he says, honey, if you love me, then come on, let's do it. Don't listen. In fact, you have my permission to punch that guy right in the nose. I'll back you up 100%. Those who love will never ask others to prove their love by doing something that is wrong. Those who love will never ask you to prove their loyalty by lying or cheating or stealing for them. That behavior is rude, and love is not rude. Love does not seek its own. You know, as you begin to read all these things and we get to them, we get sort of cut to the heart with this. There isn't any one of us that reads this passage where you consider it with all your heart that you don't get convicted and start to feel like, man, I really don't measure up. It's often been talked about where you try to take your name and put it in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And the only name that fits in there is Jesus. Any one of us who would put our name in there, well, you go, Chris is, oh, no, no, not patient. Chris is, well, kind, I'm working on that one. Does not seek its own. Which one of us does not seek its own? See, love is prepared to give up what you're entitled to. It's not selfish. Putting it plainly, love is just not selfish. It's not manipulative. It doesn't seek to get its own way. It doesn't say, I'll love you if. That's not biblical love. It's convicting because we are so selfish by nature. See, love is others-centered. That's the point. Paul says in Philippians, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. And look not out for your own interests only, but also for the interests of others. You see, we confuse love with lust in our society. Unlike God's kind of love, lust is directed toward our own selves. It's inward. Whereas God's love is outward, it's toward others. It's unselfish. When a heart is consumed with its own interest, you can't show concern and interest for others. Agape love goes against our natural inclinations to put self first. See, we're all inclined to put ourselves first. But biblical love doesn't do that. This is one that's so important in marriage, and it's part of what makes marriage tough. For we are out for ourselves in marriage. We don't get married because, wow, I can't wait to pour my life into someone else. We get married because we think that other person will meet our needs. Many times that's the case. But when we realize that we're others-centered, it will really experience what real love is when we give to one another. Well, the third thing we notice in these sections is in verse 5, the end of verse 5, is love's reaction to sin we see in these next two verses. First of all, love is not irritable. It's not provoked or easily provoked. And he said, okay, Lord, I'm not easily provoked, I don't think. But the idea is not being ill-tempered. And here's the thing. Here's the point I want to make with you folks. I want you to picture in your mind that person that pushes your buttons. That person that just bugs you beyond anybody else. Just think of them right now and think, okay, now, and I know what you think. You think, now, if they would just not be like that, then I'll be okay. But the problem is that it's not the person. It's us. Because, you know, you can't have your buttons pushed if you ain't got no buttons, if you understand what I'm saying. And the problem is our lack of love in our own life. Because love is not provoked. You can't get buttons pushed. You're not provoked. This past week, with my mother-in-law being sick early in the week and then dying on Tuesday, I had the privilege of spending the entire week with my wife's family. I was provoked on a number of occasions. And I remember thinking, Lord, why am I being provoked this week? Lord, don't you know on Sunday I have to teach on love? And then the Lord reminded me, right, that is why, because love is not provoked. And are you really loving them? And, you know, I kept it to myself, by and large. A couple of snide comments that they didn't know the meanings of. But then I come to the next one. Love thinks no evil. Busted. This may be where you think, okay, see how deep love goes? It goes into our thought life. You know, the love of God is a thought police. It goes right deep down into you. And you may be able to bite your tongue and not say what you're thinking, but it doesn't mean you're not thinking that evil thing that's going through your mind. And the word here actually is an accounting word or a bookkeeping word. It's the idea that love keeps no record of wrong. In fact, one version interprets it that way. Love keeps no record of wrong. Love forgets what others have done to them. And this is a key to not allowing bitterness to eat at your life. Because there isn't a person sitting in this room that has not had things happen to them from other people, who has not been hurt by someone else. Every one of us have got baggage. We are all dysfunctional. People go to the psychologist and say, I come from a dysfunctional family. I say, welcome to the human race. We are all dysfunctional. You know why? Adam and Eve sinned, and every single parent since then has sinned, and you all are children of sinning parents. So you're dysfunctional. We look at dysfunction in the Bible, we see the sons of Jacob, they had four moms. Talk about dysfunction. We're all dysfunctional. But love keeps no record of wrong. And when you come to the place in your life as a Christian, you give your heart to Christ, he can take away all that bitterness. He can remove that all and can give you forgiveness for every person and every situation that has ever come your way. Sadly, this past week, I witnessed someone say to another, I can never forgive you for what you did. Those words should never come from the mouth of a Christian. And even if the words don't come, it shouldn't come from the heart of a Christian. Christians need to forgive. Because, you know, Jesus said, to the measure that you forgive is the measure in which you will be forgiven. That should be enough, man, because I need lots of forgiveness. Love keeps no record of wrong. That is keeping a record of wrong. You know, there are some people who they just nurse the wrongs and they're able to repeat all the details of the wrongs. You ever notice that? I'm really glad the Lord has given me a bad memory. Like, even if I know what people did me wrong, I can't remember the details of what they did wrong. So I'm just like, well, I can't remember really what you did, so I forgive you anyway, you know. I have a saying about things. When someone says to me, I'm sorry, I say, well, I have to forgive you. I'm a Christian. And with my wife, I say, I have to forgive you. I'm your husband. When we love like Jesus loved, we keep no record of wrong. And it says, blessed are those whose sin is covered. You know, we are never more like Jesus than when we cover someone else's sin. I'm really glad of this, that the Lord doesn't keep a record of my wrongs. Aren't you? Love does not rejoice in iniquity. It does not rejoice in evil, in wickedness. Love does not enjoy it when someone else sins. A lot of times we'll say, well, I would never commit adultery. I would never be in fornication or murder or revenge. But love doesn't even rejoice in that. It doesn't enjoy it. Biblical love. Love can't rejoice in adultery, fornication, murder, revenge, drunkenness, lying, gossip. But do you know that your flesh will rejoice in those things? So if you find yourself rejoicing in those things, you know that you're practicing and living in the flesh. We're surrounded with sin in our culture. Jesus said we were going to be in the world, but it doesn't mean we need to be of the world. And we're not to be of the world. God's love and righteousness can't be separated. Love rejoices. Instead of rejoicing in iniquity, love rejoices in truth. Philippians 4:8 says, finally, my brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely and of good report, if there is any virtue and if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Chew on this, he says. Keep this in the forefront of your mind. Rejoice in the truth. Love rejoices in the truth, and we should dwell in truth. Love wants to be honest. Love wants to tell the truth. And being honest is a great part of love. In fact, honesty is the biblical basis for marriage. If you do not have honesty in your marriage, you will have trouble in your marriage. And if ultimately there isn't honesty, I venture to say your marriage will break up. Love wants to tell the truth. We need the foundation of honesty in that relationship. And I really believe this is the reason that so many couples break up, even in Christianity. They break up because they're not willing to humble themselves and tell the truth. Because, you know, we all sin. We all fall short. And when you keep something from your spouse and it goes on for a long period of time, and then all of a sudden it comes out, man, the rebuilding of that trust is brutal and difficult. And I've dealt with too many couples in those situations. Love rejoices in the truth. The truth is found in this book. Love rejoices in the word. It rejoices in the truth of this word. And then lastly, love regards life situations. It says that love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. These last four characteristics of love relate to the life situations we get in all the time. Love bears all things. Listen, I experienced that in this past week and in these past months. My wife and I, in walking through the sickness with my mother-in-law and then the death of my mother-in-law this past week, the cards and the emails and the texts and the phone calls and the encouragement from the body of Christ. That is love in action, love bearing all things, the love of the body, bearing our burdens. Sometimes it's bearing the burdens of sin with another. Love covers a multitude of sins. Love doesn't excuse sin, but it covers it. In Galatians, Paul said, bear one another burdens and thus fulfill the law of Christ. The law of Christ is the law of love. And when we bear each other's burdens, we are fulfilling that. And listen, if you have burdens, you need the body, you need the church, you need your brothers and your sisters who come alongside you and bear your burden for you and with you. That's what love is. Love bears all things. Love believes all things. God's love believes good things about others. God's love is not suspicious. I have to confess, this is one that hurts me, that cut me. I am by nature suspicious. Someone tells me something about someone maybe who's struggled for a long time, and they say, oh yeah, they got a new job, and they're going to get a new place, and they're going to do this, and they're going to do that. And I'm like, oh, well, we'll see. God's love doesn't think that way. You know, I'm sometimes like Job's friends. Job's friends saw his suffering and said, what did you do that you got into this trouble, basically? Many times someone is doing their best, and we, as Christians, can end up discouraging them because we don't believe in them. Love believes all things. When Jesus took that woman who was caught in the act of adultery, he turned to her, and when her accusers walked away, he said, go and sin no more, believing that she would, in fact, go and sin no more. Love bears all things. Love believes all things. Love hopes all things. Biblical love hopes all things. Biblical love sees failure but does not see failure as final. You know, everybody fails. Israel failed. And God spoke to them and said, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and turn from their wicked ways and seek my face, and I will hear from heaven and forgive their sin and heal their land. He said that to them as they were just coming out of idolatry. If my people will humble themselves, hopes all things. You think of the story of the prodigal son who goes away from his father and spends all his father's money. But that father is pictured in that parable as waiting and looking and longing for his son to come back, hoping all things. And maybe you're a prodigal in here today. Let me just say to you, God is hoping in you. God believes in you. God does not want you to stay away from him. God loves you, and he wants to restore you. And how many prodigals have not come back to the Lord because of maybe Christians, maybe church people, where they didn't experience the kind of love that would hope in them and would believe that they could change? That's what biblical love does. It bears all things. It believes all things. It hopes all things. Biblical love endures all things. It bears up under pressure. It hangs in there. And again, I come back to the marriage issue. This is what we need in marriage. We need enduring love. We need love that will endure all things. Because marriage ain't easy, is it? I mean, I think God really had a sense of humor when he put two people together, man and a woman, knowing how different we were. And you know, again, these young couples come and they recite their vows, and they're, you know, they've got the greatest intentions in the world, but they have no clue of the reality of what they're saying. I heard of one pastor who he had someone come to him for marriage counseling. A man came, and he came and he told him all these things that his wife had done, and all how bad she was, how wrong she was, and he had it all down, and he laid it all out. And so the pastor just said to him, okay, so I've heard what you have to say. Now, let me just ask you this. When you said your vows, did you use the words for better or for worse? The guy said, yeah, of course. He said, well, this is the worst. Go home. Go home and pray with your wife and open the Bible and stop your whining. For better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, for sickness or in health, till death do us part. That's what we say. Do we mean it? Because that's what biblical love is. Now, sadly, some get in a position where one party won't respond to that. And that, I know many, they're in that predicament, and it's sad and it's hard when they're willing to continue and the other won't. But love, when it's real love, endures all things. And biblical love, verse 8 says, love never fails. You know, the economy is going to fail one day. Hopefully not too soon. The stock market will fail. People will fail you. People will let you down, but God's biblical love will never fail. You know, we have our fallen nature that we live with, and we put up with this, and actually what we need to do is put it to death. We have role models that fall short in our eyes, but the greatest influence that God brings into our life is His love. And if we yield to Him and be conformed to His image, that love will never fail. So this week, I want you to read over 1 Corinthians several times over this week. Meditate on these things. These passages cut me open, and I believe even this morning for some has cut you open. They are convicting. But in these last days, we need this conviction. We need this love to be poured into us so that it can come out of us. Because we have a world out there, you guys, a Christ-rejecting world at this point. We have people who desperately need Jesus and His love. And they need to see what real love is. They need to see it in you, the Christian. You're the one. You are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. In fact, when Jesus says that, it's you alone. You know, a Buddhist is not the light of the world. Neither is a Muslim or a Confucius people. They're just confused. We need to allow the love of Christ to come into us and flow through us, submitting ourselves to His Spirit so that He can love people through the church. But you have to have that love in your life. The Bible says, greater love has no man than this, than he lay down his life for his friends. And Jesus said, and you are my friends, and he laid down his life for you. It says that God demonstrated his own love toward us, and that while we were still sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. While we were still sinners. You know, Christ didn't die for you when you were doing well. You're not doing well. We're all sinners. We all fall short. But Christ died for you to redeem you because of his great love. Submit yourself to his Spirit so that he can love people through you.